Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, the plight of China's Uyghur Muslim population. We'll discuss the origins and ramifications of China's well-documented brutal campaign to strip Uyghur and other Turkic minorities in the Xinjiang region of China of their culture, religion, and identity, all in the name of national security, through a network of secretive detention centers, which Beijing euphemistically refers to as re-education centers, aimed at stamping out terrorism. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. Even in this era of deep political discord in the United States, the unconscionable repression of the Uyghur population is one issue on which Republicans and Democrats, Muslims and Christians, isolationists, and internationalists agree. The State Department's 2019 annual human rights report on China says that Chinese authorities are conducting mass arbitrary detentions, forced disappearances, torture, rape, compulsory worship of President Xi Jinping and the Communist Party, and much more. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said China is in a league of its own when it comes to human rights violations, and Michael Kozak, who heads the bureau that drafted the reports, compares China's internment of more than 2 million people in Xinjiang province to Nazi concentration camps. China says it's dealing with a threat from separatist Islamist groups, and while some Uyghur Muslims have joined the so-called Islamic State group, rights groups say violence in Xinjiang stems from China's oppression of people there. U.S. Ambassador at Large for International Religious Freedom, Sam Brownback, says what China is doing is not counterterrorism. It is ugly repression on a mass scale, enabled by modern technology. The Uyghurs are one of 55 recognized minority ethnic groups living in China. Culturally and ethnically, the Uyghurs identify more closely with Central Asian countries, and their language is similar to Turkish. The Uyghurs are mostly Muslims and number about 11 million in western China's Xinjiang region. Sadly, Muslim-majority nations have been almost entirely silent about China's crackdown on the Uyghurs, possibly because of the economic clout China wields among them and the solidarity some of these states have with anti-Western authoritarian regimes. Well, joining us to discuss the plight of the Uyghur population and the economic and political obstacles that inhibit stronger action against China are Olivia Enos. She's senior policy analyst in the Asian Studies Center at the Heritage Foundation, and that's a think tank here in Washington. And Sophie Richardson, she's China director at Human Rights Watch. That's a nonprofit organization that investigates and reports on human rights abuses happening in all corners of the world. And both ladies join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having us.
It's great to be here.
Well, Sophie Richardson, let me begin with you. Let's talk just slightly about the history. When and why did the repression of Uyghurs begin in Xinjiang region in China?
Well, really, since the founding of the People's Republic of China, Uyghurs have not been given the kind of autonomy that they were essentially promised. They're not unique in that respect. Certainly, this is a problem for Tibetans and other ethnic minority communities, too.
And of course, I think it's important for us to mention, by way of background, that like Tibet, Xinjiang region is autonomous. There's a degree of self-government. But in practice, both the Tibetans and the Uyghurs face restrictions by China's central government.
That's correct. I mean, as is the case with a lot of Chinese law, you know, what's said on paper is, you know, to some extent unobjectionable. What happens in reality is an entirely different thing. And especially if you compare some of the policies that have been put in place since the latest Strike Hard Against Violent Extremism campaign, which began in 2014 in Xinjiang, the grotesque violations of the freedoms of assembly, of religious belief, of movement, and massively intrusive surveillance technology that enables the state to track and control perfectly legal behavior, I think really shows the gulf between those laws and practice.
Turning to you, Olivia Enos, please continue to add on to what Sophie said about this type of surveillance technology that China has employed and when the crackdown particularly began in earnest in China of the Uyghur population.
Yeah, I mean, even prior to the mass internment of hundreds of thousands, likely millions of people there, as Sophie mentioned, you saw individuals having their DNA collected for likely nefarious purposes. You saw actually Chinese police and otherwise quartering or living in the homes of the average Xinjiang citizen. And then, of course, now we're seeing this massive internment. And I think it's just been this slippery slope of persecution that has gotten worse and worse. And the justifications have gotten more and more elaborate. But I think especially since February of last year, when new regulations on religious affairs went into effect, we saw massive crackdowns, not only on Uyghur Muslims, but also on Christians, on Tibetan Buddhists, on the Falun Gong. You saw people of all faiths, of all stripes, essentially being told that you can't practice your faith in the way that you believe your closely held beliefs should be carried out. You have to practice it in a way that conforms with the Chinese Communist Party's ends. And one of the ways that they've made these types of elaborate policies possible is through this surveillance technology. And they're not only deploying it in the Xinjiang region, it's also even beyond. And not just within China, but also they're exporting this surveillance technology to places like Africa and Latin America. And I'm happy to go into greater detail about some of the terrifying elements of that.
First of all, back to you, Sophie Richardson. What is Beijing afraid of? I mean, what is the real reason for this type of repression and a total disrespect for the Uyghur population?
It's a great question, because you look at China today and you think, it's the second largest economy in the world. It's a P5 member state, a member of the UN Security Council. It is arguably at its most affluent, secure position in hundreds of years. Why treat a minority population this way? And if somebody from the Chinese government was part of this conversation, they would immediately say, look, we face national security threats there. There have been acts of violence, which is not entirely incorrect. There have been acts of violence in which civilians have been hurt or killed. But the Chinese government's response has been wildly disproportionate. And it has essentially shifted to a position whereby anyone who is Uyghur is immediately assumed to be a national security threat, a terrorist. You know, there's a longstanding conflation on the Chinese government's part of a Uyghur identity with separatism, with objection to Chinese rule. You know, if you couple that with Xi Jinping's desire to cynicize religion, to make everybody support the Chinese Communist Party, to live and express their thoughts in ways that are predictable and supportive of not just the state, but the party and of him in particular, anybody who deviates is really considered problematic. And so Uyghurs are now perceived, I think, by the state as being at the extreme end of that spectrum of being problematic. They're not Han. They're stalwart in their faith. They speak a different language. They don't necessarily support the Chinese Communist Party. And the net result is to really treat them as a threat.
Turning to you, Olivia Enos, to add or subtract to that explanation of what the Chinese are afraid of from the Uyghur population.
There's a really phenomenal book written by Andrew Nathan and Andrew Scobell called China's Search for Security. And in it, they both identify that China's primary goals is to maintain their own internal stability, to protect their own sovereignty. And so the majority of the book is intended to look at China's foreign policy, but it ends up focusing a lot more on China's domestic priorities, which include tamping down on places like Xinjiang and Tibet, these autonomous regions where they see potentially threats emanating that they believe could pose a threat to their own internal security and stability. And I think what you're seeing is an overreaction to that and an actualization of the true intent of their policy, a longstanding policy of the Chinese Communist Party. And I think, just like Sophie said, because they have conflated all religion with extremism, this has therefore given them a mandate to define any attempts at curtailing religious freedom as an anti-terrorism move. And that's a really, really dangerous road to go down.
And I would just add, this happens so often in our conversations, Olivia, that, you know, Beijing, I think, is also extremely concerned, not just about internal stability, but let's bear in mind that one of the main arteries of the Belt and Road Initiative, Beijing's flagship development initiative, runs right through Xinjiang. And so I think it's especially concerned that it maintain very tight control over that region, you know, as trade increases with Central Asia, as there's more traffic through that region.
And just for the benefit of our audience, Olivia, talk about the importance of China's Belt and Road Initiative. What does it signify?
The Belt and Road Initiative is China's primary economic initiative. It's not the only one, but it's really this extension and outreach to countries beyond its borders. And I think one of the really terrifying aspects of the Belt and Road Initiative is that they're using that Belt and Road in order to export surveillance technology and also to export a form of authoritarianism that's incredibly pernicious. And, you know, I will give one example in the context of Africa. In Zimbabwe, the Chinese SOE, state-owned enterprise, provided surveillance technology to the Zimbabwean government. And they not only deployed that to use against their own citizens in Zimbabwe, but they made an arrangement with the Zimbabwean government where the Chinese state-owned enterprise gets the private data of individual Zimbabwean citizens, unbeknownst to these citizens, and is using it to, as one report put it, quote, refine their technology on darker skin tones so that they can surveil better. This is terrifying. And this is the type of activities that aren't just happening in Africa, it's happening in Latin America. And in fact, Chinese police are training police forces in New Zealand, police forces in Germany. This is extending far beyond its borders. And the Belt and Road Initiative is just one mechanism for exporting that form of surveillance technology as a means of authoritarianism. And we should be very worried.
We'll have more in just a moment. But first, you're listening to Encounter on The Voice of America. Our guests are Olivia Enos, from whom you just heard. She's senior policy analyst in the Asian Studies Center at the Heritage Foundation, and Sophie Richardson. She's the China director at Human Rights Watch, and we're discussing the roots and ramifications of China's horrific treatment of its Uyghur Muslim population. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel VOA. Here's a big shout out to a loyal Encounter listener, Hassan Zafar from Muzaffarabad, Pakistan. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to our discussion about the Uyghur population in China. Back to you, Sophie Richardson, to talk a bit more about the pernicious impact of these surveillance techniques, because we know that the Chinese are using biometric identification measures to track citizens, particularly the Uyghur population, and checkpoints where Uyghurs have to show identity cards. Again, this is an incredible oppressive use of this. And as Olivia said, China is perfecting these techniques, and that has very ominous consequences.
Yeah, we have been writing for the last couple of years about the abuses of different kinds of surveillance technology. We wrote about predictive policing platforms and how they're used across China, about facial recognition, about the compulsory collection of biodata without giving people the opportunity to opt out of it. And when we started to look at how technology was being used, particularly in Xinjiang, we kept seeing references to something called the Integrated Joint Operations Platform. And when we broke this apart, we came to realize that it identified 36 different types of behavior, almost none of which were actually illegal. You were now considered suspicious if, for example, you suddenly started going out the front door of your house instead of the back door of your house. And a whole supporting architecture of surveillance technology, from CCTV cameras to Wi-Fi sniffers, feeds this information into the IGOP system. And all of this information is getting hoovered up into this particular platform, and it tells police who to go out and question, and in some cases, actually detain for perfectly legal behavior.
Back to you, Olivia, with respect to the United States, what its position is with regard to this. As I said earlier, there's a convergence of bipartisan consensus that this action that the Chinese are taking is absolutely abhorrent, and that there is a new Uyghur Human Rights Policy Act in the House and the Senate, sanctioning officials under the Magnitsky Act and or restricting export of technologies used for repression. What more can you add to that, and where does the Trump administration stand?
So you've seen officials from the Trump administration issuing highly condemning language when it comes to what's going on in Xinjiang, anywhere from the vice president to Secretary Pompeo to Ambassador at Large for International Religious Freedom, Sam Brownback. You have seen these statements coming, but where's the action? this has been really concerning that really the only elements of the U.S. government to even consider action is Congress, which is great. It's great that Congress is seeking to hold the administration accountable and to make sure that we can use the elements and the instruments of foreign policy to hold China accountable for what's going on. And yet we still haven't seen any global Magnitsky sanctions, as you referenced. Global Magnitsky can be issued based off of violations of human rights or corruption. It's important that those individuals, especially Chen Guangguo, who we know is responsible for architecting the police state in Xinjiang, but also previously in Tibet, holding him accountable seems like a no-brainer to me. As you also referenced, of course, you can hold individual businesses accountable, just the potential threat of the U.S. targeting businesses who provide the surveillance technology led to Thermo Fisher Scientific discontinuing its exports of surveillance technology to China. Really positive step. But I think there is a need to really put pressure and continue to elevate these things. The question is just when they will act.
So why do you think they're not acting, Sophie? Do you think that the Trump administration is afraid of complicating ongoing trade negotiations with Beijing and North Korean diplomacy?
I think there are a couple of different problems, one of which is that, you know, the administration has clearly prioritized trade issues significantly above all else. I think China policy at the moment could most politely be described as inchoate. There are not clear priorities or players. The administration is turning in, despite the remarks that Olivia was citing earlier from administration officials, which are important, but this administration is pretty disastrous on human rights generally. There's no dispute about that. And, you know, one of the other key international institutions in finding solutions to Xinjiang is the United Nations Human Rights Council. The U.S. has withdrawn from it and walked away, leaving others to figure out how best to hold China accountable through that mechanism. And so between sort of the hostility towards international institutions, the lack of priorities, a desire to get the trade war sorted out, a lot of these kinds of issues are really just falling through the cracks. And all of this just makes it that much easier for Beijing to keep doing whatever it wants, convinced that it will not pay a price for these horrific abuses.
And I think that the failure to respond on the Trump administration's part when it comes to Xinjiang is reflective of a broader, really serious trend in foreign policy, which is that human rights are often viewed as divorced from national security priorities, from national interests. And so I think that the responsibility is on folks in civil society like me and Sophie, but also folks in Congress and individuals who are a part of the bureaucracy in the U.S. government to start making the case more convincingly that actually addressing human rights issues has the ability to further U.S. interests. And that case can easily be made in the situation with Xinjiang because the surveillance technology itself is a national security threat. There are millions of people whose lives are hanging in the balance in these political re-education facilities there. And to not act will have severe consequences and will not be looked upon fondly in history.
Absolutely. Sophie, basically, what China is doing to the Uyghurs is a signal about its repressive power, whether internally and externally. And that's a threat to everyone in the region, the South China Sea, to Africa, to Europe, and even the Arab states, who, by the way, their silence is rather deafening. The so-called Muslim-majority states, including Saudi Arabia, obviously Pakistan, even Iran, Egypt, they have been radio silent for the most part on the repression and discrimination of their fellow Muslim brethren.
Yeah, the radio silence from members of the Organization of Islamic Cooperation has been pretty staggering, especially, I think, when you consider the fact that in the face of horrific persecution of the Rohingya Muslims in Myanmar a few years ago, that the OIC, in fact, got on board with the European Union to drive on efforts at accountability through the Human Rights Council. Now, one of the challenges, of course, with a number of OIC member states is that Iran, Pakistan, Saudi are not exactly human rights luminaries themselves. And so you don't necessarily expect them to step up and lead. at the same time, where are Malaysia? Where's Turkey? Where's Indonesia? You know, there's been some discussion in some of these countries, sometimes from civil society groups, as Olivia mentioned earlier, sometimes from members of parliament, but those have not translated into the kinds of national level support or concern that you want to see in presenting global pushback against Beijing. And I think we are starting slowly to see some steps just in the last couple of days. We've seen 22 UN member states file a joint statement at the Human Rights Council condemning China's abuses in Xinjiang. And that's a very important step forward in saying to China, you're not going to get away with this. But what we need to see is a broader chorus of states, that it's not just primarily European governments and Japan. There are some Muslim majority countries, some from the global south, who I think are increasingly uncomfortable in some ways with Chinese influence, both in their countries, but also in key international institutions that we all rely on to protect our rights.
What specific steps now do you think the international community should take to bring greater attention to these atrocities and to do something to have them stopped by China?
Well, I think if you consider different kinds of international initiatives in the face of human rights crises, often the common elements to help deter abuses are to allow independent investigators to go and assess the situation. And in this case, that would most likely take place under the auspices of the High Commissioner for Human Rights within the UN system, for them to determine the scope and the scale of abuses, to investigate China's claims that these are just vocational training schools that people get to leave when they want, and they're perfectly happy to be there. And then such an investigation, the results could be presented to a body like the Human Rights Council or even at the General Assembly in New York, with a determination to be made about whether some sort of further investigation and prosecutions are an appropriate response. Because what's not happening right now is that Beijing is not feeling enough pressure to start rethinking what it's doing. And what we need to see is a diplomatic initiative that is sufficiently displeasing to Beijing, because as far as we can tell, this is the new normal in Xinjiang. This is not a phenomenon that's going to go away anytime soon. That until authorities are convinced that everybody in Xinjiang is on board with Xi Jinping's policies, they're going to keep people in political education camps. And Beijing is not paying a price for doing that.
The final word to you, Olivia, because it just seems like the Arab states, the United States, which is in the process of trade negotiations with China, and others, that there seem to be inhibited, that they feel that China holds more clout. Saudi Arabia sells its oil to China. It wants to take part in this Belt and Road Initiative, as do other regional countries. What can be done without jeopardizing these economic ties?
Just like Sophie said, China responds to international pressure. It responds when it gets pressure from the UN. I think it's possible that there could be a total international game changer. You know, if you did have a COI report, for example, in the case of North Korea, Commission of Inquiry report from the UN was a game changer. People who only spoke about national security concerns in the case of North Korea had to talk about human rights abuses and couldn't deny them anymore. And it elevated the issue in a really remarkable way. So international pressure is one way. The second way to get that international pressure is to threaten and jeopardize China's ability to host the Olympics in the next couple of years. But I think really, you've got to hold the individuals responsible who are directly the reason why we have hundreds of thousands, potentially millions, inside these political re-education facilities, and that means targeting Chen Guangguo directly. I think that we have to stop worrying about, oh, will other countries turn toward China? The reality is that all countries in the international community are going to be dealing with both the U.S. and China as economic powerhouses. And we cannot use that as an excuse for not condemning them on serious human rights violations, because it's in our national security interest to target China for its human rights violations. But let's not forget, it's also in all of these other countries' international and national interests that they don't have their own citizens being surveilled and controlled by the Chinese government.
Well, on that ominous note, I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this particular edition of Encounter. I'd love to thank my guests, Olivia Enos, Senior Policy Analyst in the Asian Studies Center at the Heritage Foundation, and Sophie Richardson, the China Director of Human Rights Watch. Thanks, both of you, for your terrific insights on this very important matter about Uyghurs in China.
Thank you.
Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Kim Lewis for booking our guests. Our engineer was Thomas Blondet. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.
And